Welcome to Simply Scottish, a podcast of all things Scottish, with music, features, interviews, and more. On the web at www.simplyscottish.com.
Welcome to Simply Scottish, the half-hour show of music and features. I'm your host, Andrew McDermott. On this episode, an interview with author and historian Jack Nisbet on the life and work of 19th century Scottish botanist David Douglas. Listen to other episodes of Simply Scottish on our website, www.simplyscottish.com. Between episodes, you can get Scottish news, trivia, show updates, and a chance to win our monthly music giveaway sponsored by MusicScotland.com. Join in at facebook.com/simplyscottish or by following us on Twitter with the handle at simplyscottish. Being so far away from family and friends, one thing that would have warmed Douglas's heart and reminded him of home would be the occasional tune he'd recognize played on the fiddle or the flute. From the album Legacy of Scottish Fiddle, Volume 1, here's Alistair Fraser and Paul Maclis. Listening to Simply Scottish. Born in 1799 in Scone, Perthshire, David Douglas grew up with a love for nature. He began his botanical career at age 11 as an apprentice on the estate of Scone Palace. Douglas gained first-hand knowledge in the gardens and in the libraries of his employers. At Glasgow University, he met Professor of Botany William Jackson Hooker, who was impressed with the young man. Hooker recommended Douglas to the Royal Horticultural Society in London, who in 1824 sent Douglas on a plant-hunting expedition to the Pacific Northwest corner of the United States. Going beyond the more obvious collections of fellow Scotsmen Archibald Menzies and Lewis and Clark, Douglas collected samples and seeds of hundreds of plant species and introduced them to Britain and Europe. Examples include the Douglas fir, for which he's named, the Sitka spruce, sugar pine, ponderosa pine, and noble fir, as well as garden shrubs and herbs such as the flowering currant, lupin, and California poppy. Teacher, naturalist, and writer Jack Nisbet lives in the Pacific Northwest. He's author of two books on David Douglas, 2009's The Collector and 2012's illustrated David Douglas, a Naturalist at Work. Nisbet talks with Simply Scottish about Douglas, sharing his unique insight into the life of this intrepid traveller and collector. Your bio says you're an author, historian, and teacher who's focused on the intersection of human history and natural history in the Pacific Northwest. So how did you get started in that area, and what piqued your curiosity about David Douglas?
I grew up in the Carolinas and did natural history as a kid. Yeah, I had a grandmother who taught me birds, that kind of thing. In fact, it was a Scottish family who had come over just before the Revolution, and there's a lot of Nisbet scattered around in the Orkneys and then in the southern part of Scotland. So I had those kind of connections, and when I came out west, as you say, there's all these people in the fur trade looking at the landscape, and it seemed natural to me to combine the natural history and the human history together. To me, they're the same thing, because he's the first guy who is not on a fur trade payroll to come to huge areas of the Northwest. He is a naturalist. He's not trained as a botanist or anything official. His job is just to come collect plants, which the British Empire was sending collectors out all over the world to do that, because botany was how they, one of the ways they made money.
Yeah.
Selling exotic plants to manor houses to plant outside. So that made sense, but Douglas was like any naturalist. He's interested in everything. So he's, you know, birds and animals and gophers and lizards and everything he's interested in, and it cuts all these different ways, but the angle that I like to explore is how the tribal cultures led him naturally into this deeper understanding of how what he's interested in works in this area.
Well, you first tell his story in the 2009 book, The Collector. How did you manage to enter his world? Where did you go to conduct your research?
By working on the fur trade and with this guy, David Thompson, for the last three decades and a little more than that, actually. The way I work is I go outside and follow these different routes. And when I'm doing that, it turned out I was following a lot of David Douglas's routes, and those same fur trade routes follow old tribal trails. So I work with a lot of tribal elders. I lead a lot of trips identifying birds or plants, that kind of thing. So I'm sort of on it anyway. And when I realized that Douglas was the natural place to go with it, I just started consciously going to the same places he went the same week of the year. It's really simple. It's amazingly simple. And in time, you see that you're looking at, and Douglas goes out and has a journal, but at the end of every day, he has a plant list. So I can go out and see a lot of the same plants in exactly the same place the same week of the year that he does.
Huh.
And that turned out to be very powerful to me, because instead of saying, here's a place that we've ruined, here's a place where it's all weeds, here's a place where the natural landscape is completely hidden from what it was 200 years ago, I can flip that and say, here's a flower that David Douglas saw in this spot 200 years ago, this same week of the year.
Wow.
And I can show that to fourth graders or native plant societies or anything. And it's a way to look at the landscape in a fresh way that is a positive way, that then that takes you in different directions from there.
Huh. So truly retracing his steps and yet living in the moment, your own experience, and then being able to combine the two.
It collapses time.
Well, from an early age, Douglas was fascinated with natural history and the outdoors. often fashionably late as he walked to school in Perth. In what ways was Douglas the perfect candidate for his botanical expeditions to America?
I guess that collapses time, too. If you know a talented naturalist, a real charismatic naturalist, you can see them, you know, walking around, talking about this, and being totally curious and fascinated by that. And the way Douglas had a brother, John, in Perthshire, the little village of Scone where they lived, who wrote some things about Douglas as a kid that describe him, you know, looking at worms on the way to school and picking up birds that had fallen out of their nests and learning how to fish, loving fishing, loving to shoot birds on the wing as he grew up and became a hunter. That's what a naturalist does. They just can't stop looking at everything. They can't stop their enthusiasm and their curiosity. And Douglas is quite clearly that kind of person. He is magnetically attracted to sharing this the natural world with himself and everybody else around him. So he's often turning the Scottish fur agents that he's with on to birds or on to lizards. And many of them grew up in rural situations and are already good at it, so they just help him. They become his eyes. So he's writing letters back to 12-year-old kids in Britain talking about fishing for trout, but he's also getting guided out up to these places by a 12-year-old tribal kid who has much deeper knowledge who can show him that. So it's a very reciprocal kind of situation he's in. When Muir came along almost 100 years later, he saw what was happening to this natural world and was trying to sell it. Douglas was in a really different position in that, again, the Northwest and big parts of America are just a place to extract wealth from if you're in London and running a company. And Douglas is the first guy who gets to look at it fresh from a non-economic kind of view. But yet, at the same time, he's looking at trees with an eye towards replacing the forest that the Brits have cut down to build their shipbuilding industry, which is what is fueling their empire, controlling their empire. The plants he's sending back are going to get turned into cultivars by nurserymen back there and sold out of seed catalogs. The shrubs, the same thing. He's not John Muir. He is not John Muir. There's a real economic element to what he is doing, and he's really thinking about it a lot.
You actually chose to write again about David Douglas with your most recent book, David Douglas, A Naturalist at Work. How does this book complement The Collector?
The Collector is pretty much a straightforward biography of Douglas focused on the Northwest and his work in the Northwest, because that's where I am and understand it best. But the whole time I was really aiming to do this second book, A Naturalist at Work, which is a collection of essays that focus on different elements of Douglas' work and then connect them to modern times, to us. That's what I'm really interested in, is the landscape then and now. And Douglas is this great window to it then, and this idea that there's all these plants that have lasted till now crosses over into that. So I can have a chapter on the scientists in London who are really running him, who are his, you know, the people who are his teachers and bosses, and I can give context with that. But I can also have a chapter about the tribal families that he met who showed him good plants around Spokane, whose descendants I can go, that I'm teaching at school, and then I can go talk to the grandmothers and go out with them and look at the same plants and see them gathering roots that Douglas then writes the recipes down for that they're cooking.
So just as you said, using Douglas's story as a window to enter other points of Pacific Northwest history and culture?
Exactly. With this naturalist at work, there's a lot of visual elements to all this, because there's amazing plant artists in the British Empire at the time, or in London at the time, that are painting these plants and animals as he sends them back. My wife and I curated a museum exhibit that goes with these two books. It's in Spokane right now, but we'll be moving to Tacoma, to the Washington State History Museum in Tacoma in fall 2013. Just going through that with tribal members or foresters or fishing game workers or third graders, you know, every time you go through it, they point out things that are different windows, different places to go with this kind of ideas that we're talking about.
One of the instruments popular during Douglas's time was the barrel organ, a mechanical instrument of bellows and pipes. Activated with a crank or by clockwork, the organ played tunes encoded into wooden barrels or cylinders. Northwest Company agent David Thompson describes taking his barrel organ over the Rocky Mountains in 1807. Douglas may well have enjoyed music from such an instrument during his stays with the Hudson's Bay Company. Here's a sample of barrel organ music now, a medley that includes the tunes Fife Hunt and Lord MacDonald's Reel. In today's age of comfortable travel, it's sometimes hard for us to imagine the challenges Douglas faced during his expeditions. He truly risked life and limb, and I doubt that he was paid enough for it. What sort of difficulties did Douglas endure on his travels?
Oh, well, this is funny. It seems insane to us, but it's what everybody's doing. So he gets, you know, to get to the northwestern London, you have to sail around the Horn on a square-rigged ship, which is dangerous for sure, and they lose people all the time, but it's what everybody did, and it takes 9 months. During the 10 or 11 years that he's out collecting, 2.5 of them are just at sea. So that becomes another essay in the book, is what he's doing when he's just crossing the Columbia Bar, which is a really serious business. Same when he is on the rivers here. You can crash your canoe, and all kinds of terrible things can happen, but the fur trade the British fur trade has spent decades learning how to navigate and paddle and haul stuff up and down rivers, upstream and down, and all Douglas is ever doing is traveling with fur trade brigades. So when he's on the rivers, if he's nervous about it, he gets out and walks and lets the voyageurs paddle around.
Yeah.
Then the same thing when you go up a little creek, he is either with a fur trade handler or he is with tribal people who have gotten the word from a headman that leave this guy alone, protect him, don't let anything happen to him. And that's the way the fur trade treats him, too, is he's sort of this wacky guy who could easily fall off a cliff, but we're going to protect him. And they keep him alive for 10 years. And it's funny that when he finally dies, it's one of the few times he's by himself the whole time he's out. In his journal, it often sounds like he's by himself, but he's never by himself. The Hudson's Bay Company has been told to protect him. And so John McLaughlin, who's another Scott, who's in charge of the Hudson Columbia District, lends him a horse, has a guy to carry his stuff. You know, he's under this aura of protection, either fur trade or tribal, most of the places that he is.
And I'm sure that was the case when he capsized in the Fraser River as well. He was with a group, correct?
No, well, when he came back, he had some of his guys with us, but he had decided to not continue on with the fur trade brigade and go by himself, which might have been the problem. And that's another theme of all of his journeys. He has help choosing his plants and identifying his plants and sending his plants back. It's not him alone. He's just a window into this larger group and array of people who are sending all this stuff back and forth. Communication is a lot better 200 years ago than we think of it. Letters. He sends a lot of letters, as everybody else does at that time. So we can sort of see where he's doing with letters and some survey notebooks that he fished out of the Fraser and sent back. We have some latitudes and longitudes and dates, you know, so you can trace him in a survey, a map, good book of maps that he did that survived. But we don't know his day-to-day activities, and he lost all of his specimens for 2.5 years, which is it's really a loss. But yet, if you look at other collectors who went all to Africa and China and the South Seas and everything, everybody loses stuff. It's the nature of the game. It's canoes tip over. That's the nature of them. And so what's amazing is all the stuff we did get back, which is hundreds and hundreds of plants. And you can go retell his story by going to Kew Gardens in London and looking at those specimens and then tracing them out. They have dates on them. They have habitat information on them. Then going back to the Fraser or to California or to the Blue Mountains or to, you know, Puget Sound, and looking at what he got there, and you can sort of retell the natural part of the story.
Well, was this incident a factor in him deciding to return to the UK then?
No, he had already been back to Great Britain sort of midway in these journeys we're talking about. He came over, let's see, he took a trip to New York in 1823, and did the eastern mid-Atlantic states and a lot of the eastern seaboard and went west as far as Detroit. Then he went back to London. He was very successful, published a wonderful paper on oaks, and that got him a job in the Columbia. So he came out here in 1825. Then in 1827, he went back to London again, the long way, going across Canada to Hudson Bay. Then he published a bunch of papers again and did some really terrific scientific work in London for the next 2 years. Then in 1829-30, he comes back to the Columbia, stops in California, stops in Hawaii, does all these different kinds of things. Then he dumps in the Fraser in 1833, and that really doesn't stop him doing what he's doing. He comes back down the Columbia collecting plants and starts a new journal and then goes to California and Hawaii again and ends up in Hawaii collecting and says he's going to come back to London.
Yeah.
That's when he dies.
So what's your view of Douglas's death? I know you recount it in The Collector, and I know that it may never be known exactly what happened. Which direction do you lean in terms of the mystery?
Well, I love things like this, as do we all, and it's very similar to Meriwether Lewis, where a famous guy dies young under mysterious circumstances, and then people speculate about it for years to come. It's like Jimi Hendrix or somebody like that, too. Basically, if you're a historian, you go, the accounts closest to the time that it happens by the most dependable people tend to be the best source of information. And by the time Douglas died, he fell into a cattle pit trap and was trampled to death by a bull that was already in the bottom of the trap. And by the time David Douglas died, he was already a cult figure to naturalists all over the world. Two of them had been sent to the Columbia to continue his work, and one was a medical doctor named Meredith Gairdner, who was there, who met Douglas, and then Douglas went to Hawaii. And Meredith Gairdner contacted tuberculosis and was sent to Hawaii the next year to recover. And he naturally went to exactly the same place where Douglas died to see what had really happened. The same question that you have, you know, what really happened? And Meredith Gairdner went there, and he wrote a wonderful letter back to England, where everybody else was wondering what happened, where he said, "The natives warned him about the dangers of the pit, but his curiosity overcame his caution, and he ventured too far near," which I love, as in other words, saying it's just an accident. Then, only 5 years after that, the Wilkes expedition came, and there were two naturalists on that, who to Douglas was a hero too, and they went to the same place to look and see what happened. And while they were there, a Hawaiian guy whose job it was to kill bulls and get them out of the pit and skin out their hides fell into a pit and was trampled to death by a bull. Huh. So they said it was an accident. So I'm willing to go with accident, but believe me, there's a whole industry of people using it, doing it as conspiracy, murder, sure, robbery theories, and I honor them. They can say whatever they want. Because, as you say, nobody's ever going to really know.
Yeah.
But that's another interesting thing about it. He was 35 when he died. He really had a lot of health issues, including likely having rheumatoid arthritis. He had a lot of eye issues. When he went back to London in 1828-30, like many Scottish kids who went out into the big world away from the empire, away from the homeland, and were able to rise to the level of their ability, when they came back to this really strict class society, they struggled. And mm-hmm. Douglas was the son of a stonemason from a little village, and he really struggled in, like, London scientific society. So he describes himself as being mad and worn out, and he was a prickly character for a lot of people in London. So I don't know what he – I don't – maybe he – what I see is that we're really lucky to have gotten 12 years of top-quality collecting out of them, and more than a dozen amazing scientific papers and all these thousands of plant collections that are acute. We got a lot. He did a lot of stuff by age 35. So I don't know. I don't know that he did die so young, maybe.
Mm.
Maybe he just lived his life really intensely, so he was an old 35.
What is Douglas's legacy in your estimation?
It's also very complex and shoots off in all kinds of different directions. You know, for me, as a naturalist, it's a fabulous legacy where I can go think about the landscape that I'm in today and compare what he saw to it. That's very powerful in a time when we think of the world changing through global warming, for instance. You know, we have blooming dates for all these flowers that he sees. But for the timber industry in Europe and all over the former British Empire, he's the one that really sent back viable seed that allowed them to grow trees. I mean, the most commonly planted commercial tree in Scotland and Ireland and England is the Sitka spruce. Well, that's a Douglas introduction, and he wrote eloquently about how well he thought it would do. On the other hand, that drives a lot of ecologists crazy. They'd rather see the native landscape back in Great Britain, and the Sitka spruce and the Douglas fir and these other trees that he introduced are in the way of that. You get so he is a different person to everybody, and if you a lot of the plants that he introduced back are now, several of them have taken over as real troublesome weeds in the North Country and in UK and over into Scandinavia, and that's, you know, in the U.S., we spend all this time complaining about Eurasian weeds that have come taken over here. They go back the other way, and Douglas sent a lot of them back the other way. So I think, to me, one of the legacies that I get is how powerful plants and trees are as individual species and how they aren't so easy to control. And Douglas had amazing insights about a lot of them, but they override those and change and turn into really something else. So I tend to go through executive plant by plant, I guess, and there's a lot of them. There's 600 from here, another 600 from California. So each one is an individual story. It is indeterminate when you trace it all out. There's a lot to his legacy.
Well, Mr. Nisbet, thank you for taking some time to illuminate the life and work of David Douglas. Certainly an extraordinary fellow in a very interesting time in history.
I agree. Yeah, thank you. My pleasure.
That's it for this episode of Simply Scottish. Visit simplyscottish.com for a complete archive of episodes, as well as featured music and other information. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter to get show updates, Scottish trivia, and a chance every month to win a free CD of Scottish music. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/simplyscottish, and our Twitter handle is @simplyscottish. We'll close with music from David Douglas. No, not the Scottish botanist, but the 21st century Dutch musician. Utrecht-based producer David Douglas has found inspiration in the former Douglas's compelling story. In his debut EP, Royal Horticultural Society, he uses Douglas's story and themes of nature to create rich and atmospheric sounds. We'll listen to a track called Douglas Firs. I'm Andrew McDermott. Join me again for more of All Things Scottish on Simply Scottish.
Simply Scottish is hosted and produced by Andrew McDermott. Show content, copyright 2013, Simply Scottish Media. All music is used with consent of copyright holders. Continue your Simply Scottish experience at simplyscottish.com. Thanks for listening.